Welcome to Season 2 of the Santam Ensure Your Future Money Bootcamp with me, Mapalo Maku.
And me, Maya Fisher-French. We invite you to join our conversations and use these as both motivation and information to kickstart your own personal financial transformation. Now, over the last 2 months, we've been speaking a lot about debt and assets. But do you know how much your marriage contract impacts every part of your financial life? Marriage in South Africa comes in various forms, and it's important to understand, firstly, when you are considered married, and also how your marriage regime affects your finances.
And to help us unpack this, we are joined by attorney mediator Lerato Seroke. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Lerato, let's start off by dispelling the notion of common law marriage and why recognizing a marriage is important from a financial perspective. So we're talking about inheritance, pension, divorce, and tax here.
All right. So, Mapalo, one of the common myths in South African law is that when you live together and you have been in a relationship for a very long period of time, that you are considered married. But in our law, there is no such thing as a common law marriage. And what that does essentially is exposes couples to so-called butt and sit or cohabitation relationships to potential risks if they are not informed. So if you are not married, you will, for example, not enjoy the benefits or protections such as inheritance, such as claiming for your spouse's divorced, your ex-spouse or deceased spouse's pension interests. You will not, for example, be able to claim spousal maintenance upon the dissolution of that relationship. Whereas when you are married, you have certain legal protections. So I think, first of all, people in long-term committed relationships who classify themselves as being life partners need to be aware of steps that they need to take to protect themselves while they are still in that relationship at the inception, not when things are about to break down.
And, you know, Lerato, you mentioned, I mean, certainly very important, you know, if somebody passes away without a will, they will look at, there's interstate inheritance, which will look at the spouse and what defines a spouse. But the other one that I've picked up quite often is actually on the tax side as well. So SARS donations tax, for example, can become an issue if you're not legally married and one partner perhaps puts in a huge amount of money into the other person's bank account, for example. Those sorts of issues can actually trigger donations tax. So it's actually quite in South Africa, quite a legal quagmire if you're actually not married. But when are you considered married in South Africa? Because, you know, if I look at myself, right, I follow the traditional route. You know, we got married, we had a marriage officer, we signed the documents, it was a registered marriage. Pretty simple. But I mean, Mapalo, customary marriage, you followed a different route. At what point are you actually considered married?
So for example, with me, Maya, in my culture, in the Sotho culture, they sent the letter, right? Then after having sent the letter, they come. Obviously, my parents have to say, okay, yes, you can come through. We want to hear your story, right? They get there and they agree to say, all right, yes, we will go through with this. And they leave the first half of the lobola and they leave. Then a second date is agreed upon to say, we are going to come back on this day to finish off the lobola. But what I did, me being very naughty and my husband, well, my boyfriend then, I said, because we know that this is what we want to do, let's go sign an antenuptial contract. So we met the notary even before, after we knew that the letter had been sent, before the parents started having this talk. So at what point then was I married in that scenario?
Okay, so I think let's just go back to Maya's question, because that will then help us unpack your question. There are three types of valid marriages in our law. The first being a civil marriage, the second being a civil union, and the third being a customary marriage, which is what you have entered into with your husband. So in terms of a civil marriage, that is where you have one man and one woman who are both over the age of 18, who have both consented to being married, whose marriage was officiated by a registered marriage officer, and where the marriage was registered at Home Affairs. Okay. And in a civil marriage, it is necessary for you or the parties in the civil marriage to have a marriage certificate. That is what will classify it as being valid. The second type of valid marriage in our law is a civil union. So the civil union, it is governed by the Civil Union Act, and this is an act that came into effect in 2006. The reason being, prior to 2006, partners of the same sex were not able to enter into a marriage legally. So the Civil Union Act then allowed partners of the same sex to enter into marriages legally, as well as partners of opposite sexes. So civil union is when there are two partners and they enter into a valid marriage by consent, and the marriage is also officiated by a marriage officer and registered at Home Affairs. The difference between the two is with a civil marriage and a civil union, civil marriage specifies the place for a marriage to be considered valid. So, for example, you need to be married at Home Affairs, at court, or in a church, whereas a civil union doesn't do so because it doesn't want to limit the environment in which same-sex marriage can be conducted. So those are the first two, the third being the customary marriage. So the customary marriage differs from the civil marriage and the civil union because it allows more than one spouse in that marriage. By consent, obviously. And in a customary marriage, you do not need to register it for it to be valid. So you don't need to go to Home Affairs for it to be valid. So that is often why we see cases where parties want to divorce, or where somebody dies in a customary marriages, it leads to complications. But you don't need to actually register your customary marriage for it to be valid. You do need to consent, and the parties both need to be over the age of 18. But if they aren't, then you need legal consent from an adult in that case.
But now, Mapalo, in your case, you did go and register your marriage with Home Affairs. So that was quite simple. If Mapalo and her husband part ways, I'm not saying your offense ever will, but if you did, it's quite easy to say there was a marriage, it was registered at Home Affairs. But what if they had not registered the marriage? And now there's a divorce, or I suppose, or there's a pension claim, or something happens. How do you go and prove that you were married?
And this is a problem that we see in practice often, where, for example, a spouse dies suddenly or one of the parties wants to get divorced. So let's deal with one of the parties wanting to get divorced and the problems I've seen in practice. So what would happen there is, let's say the wife, which is usually the case, approaches us for assistance for her divorce. We then need to get background into how she was married, who was there, when was Lobola done, pictures, invitations, any sort of evidence that she can provide to us so that I could then advise her on before we approach the court for this divorce. Oftentimes, as attorneys, we tend to try to settle matters between each other. So we'd reach out to the husband and say, look, your wife has come to us for a divorce. What are you saying? Can we settle this, or do we need to go to court? In most cases, the man will deny the existence of the marriage. So that is where we need records. That is where we need proof. That is where we need to build a case. So what we often tell clients is, leading up to the finalization of your customary marriage, it is very important to keep records. Mm-hmm. Keep records of the letters that are written to the wife's family asking for her hand in marriage. Keep record of the lobola receipts. So those are the receipts outlining, for example, what must be paid, what has been paid, what is due to which family. Keep record of your lobola invitations, because oftentimes there's not just one lobola celebration. There's more than one. Keep record of photos. Keep your videos. If there are witnesses there, try to have them write statements, because oftentimes we've seen when we go to court, sometimes, let's say, an elderly grandparent was there. By the time you're going for a divorce, that grandparent has now passed away. So how will we then prove this as a credible witness? So I would advise parties to just keep records, keep WhatsApp messages. Also, during the course of the relationship, make sure that you record that, for example, you have put your spouse as a beneficiary or nominated them as a beneficiary in your policies as spouse. Okay. Make sure, for example, in a will, draft a will. I will always advise people to draft a will. In your will, make sure that you clearly set out that your spouse is your spouse. Mm. Because then when it comes to proving the validity of this marriage, that will assist your case. Mm.
But I mean, obviously you can simplify the whole thing by registering your marriage at Home Affairs.
Of course.
Then if you've done that, you don't have to worry too much about all the documentation. I think that's the, to me, that would be perfectly honest, the easiest, easiest method. But maybe there's a reason not to register with Home Affairs. I mean, what would stop somebody going and registering it with Home Affairs?
Look, I wouldn't say you are correct in saying the easiest way is to register, but I think you need to take the context of our country economically and historically into account. First of all, a lot of the people who are still entering into customary marriages without registering them tend to be those in locations or in rural areas. And they still have the mindset that having your lobola negotiations, having your customary celebrations is enough. Mm. We don't need to go the legal route. We don't need to do, some of them don't do the white wedding even. So why would I need to approach Home Affairs to register it? The other thing is practical difficulties. So hurdles. If I'm living in a rural area, getting transport to Home Affairs to register a marriage is not in my interest. Sometimes there's misinformation about the costs of registering a marriage. Some people believe it's, you know, quite exorbitant, which is not the case. Mm-hmm. And other times we find that the husband generally tends to want to protect his interests because he knows that by registering this marriage, he is sort of formalizing it, not that it's not formalized if it's not registered. And so he is sort of protecting his interests. He knows that it will take his wife a lot more financially and mentally to prove the validity of this marriage.
So you're saying often that the husband will be the one resisting.
That's what I've seen in practice.
And it's quite interesting because I know you and I have had a discussion about this before. And obviously one of the other things you can do is you go to family members to testify that you are married, and you've seen mother-in-laws turn around saying, oh, she's not my daughter-in-law.
Yes, mother-in-laws, sister-in-laws, even children. So for example, if it is the husband's second marriage or first marriage, but he has children from a previous relationship, the same children who were raised by, for example, the wife wanting a divorce will deny, no, this was just my father's girlfriend. The mother will, for example, say, no, I may have referred to her as Makoti, but it doesn't mean that they were married. It was just a loving term, a term of endearment that we used as a family. Mm-hmm. So even, I suppose, the husband side of the family can turn against the wife when, you know, it leaves her in a very vulnerable position. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes what we say is, keep record of those WhatsApps. If you have WhatsApp messages or text messages between yourself and your husband's family showing that proof, but also things such as wills, as I've said to you, nominating each other on policies, any other contractual documents that can show that you have been recorded as a spouse.
Now, I have seen instances where someone was married perhaps in the rural area and they never went to Home Affairs, so they don't have that marriage certificate. Then perhaps they are working in Johannesburg and they find someone that they like and they hardly ever go home now. And the person who's here and perhaps is more aware of these things, they say, you know what, if you want to get married, let's go to Home Affairs. Which marriage is valid between the two? Because he is married where he comes from, and now you have someone who has taken him to Home Affairs, and now there's a marriage certificate. Who is right in this case? And are both marriages valid?
So both marriages will not be valid. The initial marriage will be valid if it is proven to be a marriage. So the onus then rests on the first wife to prove the validity of this marriage. Oftentimes when the second marriage is happening, especially if it's happening in terms of our Marriages Act, I suppose that husband can go to Home Affairs and say, I was never married. There's no proof of that. And then it will be made official by way at Home Affairs. But if the first wife gets wind of this, the onus will be on her to prove the validity of the first marriage. And oftentimes we see that, for example, where the husband dies.
Yes.
And now the first wife wants to claim. And she is turned back and she is told, you are not the wife, this is the wife. And before we can pay out, you will need to prove who is the wife.
We see this on pension fund claims. I come across this all the time. And incredibly important. I must just say, I've got a case at the moment with the husband. He's the survivor. The wife's passed away. And they were never, it was a traditional marriage, but they've been together for like 20 years. Now, you've been together 20 years. There's no lebola letters. The people who were there were not, you know, around anymore. They've all passed away. And he's struggling now to actually prove that this relationship of 20 years was actually a marriage. It is complicated, and especially on a death situation. And, you know, I was thinking about family members who deny the relationship. Believe you me, when there's a pension on the line, they're going to deny as any other person who has any, you know, any option of having any of that money. So it is.
Is it because now perhaps they died without a will and now it's going to.
Well, a pension, remember, a pension will look at a legal dependent and a legal dependent's a spouse. And they will say, no, that spouse, there was no spouse, so all the money goes to the children.
She was just visiting.
Yeah. it gets very tricky.
So I think Maya is correct. Oftentimes, pension, even policies, they don't really look to the will. So even if there was a will, they look at the nominated beneficiary. So if I haven't been nominated as a beneficiary in the pension document or in the policy document, and I've been with this man, for example, for 20 years, he dies, his family denies me, then I am at risk. I have to spend hundreds of thousands of rands to try and claim whatever he has left behind. So, I mean, we do see those unfortunate cases in practice.
Right. So I hope everyone listening understands the importance of making sure you have a record of this relationship. And unfortunately, Narata, I know we're going to have people saying, oh, but you're always talking about the woman. Women are vulnerable. We
absolutely
are. That is what it's changing. And I think you've said it is changing. But most cases, the women are vulnerable. And there's a reason the husband may not be wanting to register that marriage. Mm-hmm. So if he's resisting registering the marriage, maybe a little bit of a red flag and start collecting the information. But I want to come to the point that Mapalo made about her marriage, and she mentioned that she signed an antenuptial contract before she got married. I think it's very important for us to unpack the type of marriage regimes in South Africa.
All right. So there are three marriage regimes in our country. The first being in community of property, the most commonly recognized. Second being out of community of property with the accrual. And the third being out of community of property without the accrual. So in community of property, how I would explain it is basically the assets that you have before and during the marriage and the liabilities. So your debts that you have, everything that you owe and everything that you own before and during the marriage, you pool together as spouses. And upon dissolution of that marriage by death or divorce, then you divide it equally. It is divided equally. Okay. So the risks there are obviously if during the course of the marriage, for example, you marry a successful businessman, something happens along the way, he incurs a lot of debt, you as the wife are then at risk for paying that debt back. Oftentimes we see cases where during a long marriage, the husband, for example, finds himself with an extramarital child born during that marriage. And for example, he will not be paying maintenance. The mother of that extramarital child approaches the maintenance court. And then the maintenance court makes a maintenance order against the husband. But because he is married in community of property, it affects the joint estate. So essentially, you as the wife, who did not partake in the extramarital activities, you are then liable if he is unable to fulfill the debt. Okay? Because there's one pot.
So out of my salary, I would be required to pay for...
If he is unable to. So if something happens to him...
And if you try and go and get divorced now... Because now you're really upset with him.
He gets to take...
There's still a claim against in the divorce, you could still be liable for his debts. I mean, this is what people don't understand when they get into these marriages.
Yes.
Yeah.
And another thing just to add there, Maya, and we've spoken about this before, that even if there's no divorce, let's say your partner goes under dead review by virtue of being married in community of property, you yourself are under dead review.
Mm. And this is the default marriage in South Africa.
It is.
If you don't do what Mapalo and I did and went and signed an antenuptial contract, you are married in community of property, including customary marriage.
So if you don't sign an antenuptial contract before lobola negotiations are concluded, so I would often advise clients or parties to a customary marriage to sign the antenuptial contract even before the uncles go and negotiate. Okay? Sometimes that is not possible. So then I would advise parties in that customary marriage to make sure that they sign the antenuptial contract before the lobola negotiations are concluded, because sometimes there's more than one. So oftentimes we find there's the first meeting, the second meeting, the third meeting. In other cases, some families are able to resolve the lobola negotiations in one day. And I think that's where my advice about parties signing the antenuptial contract before the finalization comes in. Because once the lobola negotiations have been finalized and the customary marriage is celebrated, you are then married in community of property if you have not signed an antenuptial contract. Mm. And if you want to change that, it is a costly and time-consuming court process that you'd need to go through.
But what if someone says, okay, well, we did the meetings, we concluded lobola negotiations, we didn't sign this thing. Well, now I know from Lerato that I'm married in community of property, but I have not gone to Home Affairs to sign. And someone can say, well, do I have room right now to go and sign an antenuptial contract?
Before registering it with Home Affairs.
So remember, registering it in terms of the customary marriage, I'm not speaking to the other two marriages. Registering your marriage, your customary marriage, does not mean that that concludes the marriage. The marriage is concluded before you go to Home Affairs. Home Affairs is just rubber stamping it because you don't need to register a customary marriage for it to be valid in our country. So if somebody wants to try and attempt to do an antenuptial contract between lobola being concluded and celebrations having been partaken in and then going to Home Affairs, you're still late. You're still married in community of property. So those are the risks. And oftentimes, you know, one party may say, look, the timing for me was I considered it to be in community here and there. Then a court needs to deal with that.
All right. So that's in community of property. That's if you do not sign an antenuptial contract. But what if you do? What does that mean?
So if you sign an antenuptial contract, in terms of our law, you are married out of community of property. And there are two ways in which you can be married out of community of property. The first being with the accrual. With the accrual simply means I walk into the marriage and you walk into the marriage and we have two separate estates. Whatever I had leading up to the marriage is mine. Whatever you had leading up to the marriage is yours. During the marriage is where we sort of merge our estates, but we still are independent of each other financially. After the marriage, so if you die or if we divorce, that is where we look to the accrual, the growth of your estate. And what we do there, it's a calculation. Essentially, what will happen is we look at what the wife, for example, accrued during the marriage and what the husband accrued, and the party who accrued the less amount will then have an entitlement to half the difference of the growth of both of the parties. So I suppose with the accrual, it's more of a fair share, but you're still financially independent. Whereas within community of property, you are not financially independent. You need consent for a lot of your transactions and everything is in one pot.
And of course, debt isn't part of the
debt
accrual.
Well, when we are calculating the accrual, to get your accrual, we look at your assets and your liabilities. So debt is part of it. But unlike in community of property marriages, I am not liable for your debt when I am married out of community of property. Mm-hmm. So if I am liable to pay my creditor and I cannot fulfill that and they want to attach an asset, they will not come after your asset in lieu of me not having an asset available. Mm. So that's
that
the difference.
Sort of protecting each other also in marriage.
Absolutely.
Yeah. For me, that feels like love. Like we are protecting each other because, for example, if both of us are in business and something happens with his business, I'm still protected. I can still take care of the family, isn't it?
Mm. Are you married ANC with accrual?
No.
Just pure ANC?
Yes.
Oh, no accrual. Interesting. That's the other. I am married with accrual. but my husband and I, when we got married, we were 23. We were told by our attorney that our marriage wouldn't last. We just celebrated 30 years. So it did. but we came in with nothing. So probably accrual made the most sense for us. Anyway, it wasn't like we were protecting different assets. We had nothing. I think we didn't even have a dining room table. I mean, we had nothing. but what about Mapalo's contract? She didn't go with accrual.
So she's married out of community of property without the accrual, which means essentially everything is separate. So what she made before the marriage and what she makes during the marriage, her husband has no claim to. Assets and liabilities. So that is what is mine is mine. And here we find it more benefit. Well, oftentimes we find this benefits parties who have had more than one marriage. We find it benefits parties who are older. So for example, if this is my first marriage and I am you know, maybe 54 and I have accrued wealth during the course of my life, I do not feel comfortable sharing it with my partner. I love him, but I need to protect my own interests. So oftentimes, parties who tend to veer for out and out, it tends to be a subsequent marriage, or it's a marriage where a party is entering it for the first time, but at a later stage in their life where they have a lot to lose if the other party would die or if they were divorced.
So that's an interesting observation, because Maplo, yours was a first marriage.
Yes.
So why?
Hopefully my last.
Hopefully your last. So why did you choose not to have the accrual, and how do you manage your finances? If you and a fiancé decide to buy a property together, for example, or how do you go about doing it?
So for me, Maya, why we decided to get married out of commuter of property without the accrual, I just said, you know what, I'm going to build my own assets. And I think for me as a woman, it has empowered me to be very intentional with my finances. I know that, God forbid, should ever, if he wants a divorce, I'm aware of my finances every single time. I know I'm going to have to take care of myself. But how we manage our finances, I find that sometimes we manage our finances together more than people who are married in community of property. Because yes, some people do have the contract of being married in community of property, but their finances are worlds apart. We talk about everything. Okay, our investments, this are our goals, and this is what we want to do for our children. So if we're buying a property, for example, together, he will say, all right, it's going to be both in our name. But I know it carries a risk. If we get divorced, he's going to either have to, we're either going to have to sell the property and share 50-50, or I'm going to have to buy him out and, or he buys me out. So I'm aware, acutely aware of the risks, but I'm comfortable with them.
Rati, you want to add to that?
I think that's a very wise choice, especially because I assume leading up to the marriage, you had generated quite a bit of wealth and you wanted to protect yourself. You didn't want to find yourself in a situation whereby if you were to divorce your husband, you were going to be in a financially vulnerable position, having to start from zero, which is what we see in practice, unfortunately. So what you have done essentially is enter into a business contract, so to speak, when it comes to the property. So there, if there was a divorce or if your husband did die and you could not agree to what will happen to the property, either he would need to buy you out or you would need to buy him out, or you would sell that property and split the proceeds equally. If there's still no agreement, you would need to approach the High Court and get a court order dealing with the division of that asset that you've jointly acquired. Mm-hmm.
And I think just to add to this is that one of the things that you do have is, you know, you do have children together, and you can still, it's in the case of a divorce, apply for maintenance for the children, for example. So
yes,
it's not like you totally split. The fact that you have shared children together still gives you some sort of protection if you wanted to claim for maintenance and things like that. Am I correct?
Absolutely. And there are other protections. So if we're looking at maintenance will always apply. Even if you aren't married, but in your case, if you did divorce, you could approach the court for maintenance for your children. And both of you, both you and your husband, have a legal obligation to maintain your children until they are self-sufficient, not until they are 18. That's another misconception that parents have, that I am legally obligated until my child is 18. That is not what our law says. Your child could be 18, 19, even 25, and not self-sufficient. Until they are self-sufficient, you need to maintain them.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So now, Lerato, let's talk about death, right? We are married out of commuter property without the accrual system. Should any one of us pass away, we both have wills and we've put each other in our wills. But what happens then for people who are married out of commuter property and do not have a will? How does the court deal with that? Now, obviously, that person might have a pension, a retirement annuity, some assets. How do the courts deal with that?
So if you die without a will, in terms of our law, you are dying intestate. So what will happen is whatever you have acquired during the course of your life is then dealt with. There's a, I suppose, I wouldn't say a calculation, but a way in which the estate is managed. And they will look to children, they will look to relatives of the deceased person and they will look to the spouse. And then there is percentages apportioned according to your relationship to the deceased. In some cases, you may not have a will, but you have policies, you have pensions with your employer, but you have nominated your spouse. That is more favorable to the spouse. But everything falling outside a pension or a policy where you have not specifically nominated anybody will be dealt with as intestate by the master dealing with your with the deceased estate.
But this is the importance of recognized marriage, because they will look to the spouse. Now you have to prove that you were
if you were not married.
So if you even were living together for 20 years and you have no evidence of that marriage, then you may in an interstate situation not be deemed a spouse, and you'd have spent a lot of time proving it. So again, it comes back to this recognition. And I want to come on to life partnerships. I want to end with that because there is going to be some changes to our laws in South Africa. But I just want to quickly check. We spoke about African customary marriage. What about Islamic? Because there's been quite a big constitutional court case recently, and I know many of our listeners could possibly be married under the Islamic customary law.
Yes. So in 2022, the Constitutional Court handed down a judgment which changed the landscape of our law or law affecting parties to an Islamic marriage. So parties to an Islamic marriage are married in terms of what is known as Sharia law. So in terms of Sharia law, how assets are dealt with is what is mine and what is yours. As the husband, I pay a dowry that belongs to you as the wife. And I also pay you maintenance during the course of that marriage, but it doesn't mean you have an entitlement to my estate. That's what Sharia law says. So if we divorce, if I die, you take what you came with and I keep mine, or my family will take what I have. Okay. Now with this constitutional court judgment, what it's done is, number one, it's validated Islamic marriages. It said until legislation has been passed. So it's an interim position. It's not a final position. Legislation is still it's in the process of being enacted. It was supposed to be enacted last year, but these things take time. But until such time as legislation is enacted, if you were married on or after December 2014, you are then able to claim relief in terms of this judgment. And the relief available to you is, number one, you can seek a divorce in terms of South African Divorce Act. You are covered by the protections offered by our act. Number two, as a spouse, you can claim spousal maintenance. So you can claim spousal maintenance for support after the marriage. But again, I think your viewers and listeners need to be aware that spousal maintenance, even in our South African recognized marriages, is not an automatic right. You still have to prove it. Unlike maintenance for children, that's automatic. The other thing that this judgment has done is that it's placed a default position with regards to the division of the estate post-divorce or on death. And the default there is out of community of property without the accrual. Now, this, I suppose, places a disadvantage on the woman if she was a homemaker during the course of the marriage, because all it says is essentially, yes, you can get a divorce in terms of South African law. You may possibly qualify for spousal maintenance. It's not a guarantee. You can claim for your children's maintenance, but you're still walking away with nothing. So what then does a woman in that position do? And because the Constitutional Court has allowed protections of the Divorce Act, it says that if a spouse has sufficient grounds, can prove to the court, so the spouse claiming what is called redistribution. So redistribution of assets is a claim where you say, I acknowledge that my spouse and I entered into this contract that says if he were to die, or if I were to die, or if we divorce, I walk away with nothing. But given my contributions during this marriage, I don't believe it's fair for me to walk away with nothing, because I have indirectly or directly contributed to the growth of his estate. Had it not been for my contributions, he, and it's generally the man, he would not have acquired this wealth. So I am entitled, I believe, on these grounds, and you'd set out the grounds that you believe you're entitled to, some portion of his wealth, not all of it. So I think women in those marriages, because of this judgment, have that relief, but they need to prove. the redistribution.
It's always come down to proof.
Yeah.
And I think that brings us up to maybe the last point that I want to make. And we do have the South African Law Reform Commission underway, which is looking at all of these marriage regimes, looking at customary marriage, all of these things to try and bring it all in line and making it all more equitable. And we also have had the Judicial Matters Amendment Bill, which recognizes life partnership in an interstate environment. There's this move towards recognizing life partnerships. So we will move away from this kind of, well, you have to, you know, register your marriage with Home Affairs. So we're moving a little bit more into the common, what we would think of common law marriage. But Lerato, it still requires you to prove this relationship. And so what, I just want to end off by saying, how do you prove that you have been in a life partnership?
It's all about keeping records because women and men in those arrangements are vulnerable. So at the inception of this life partnership, so when you become aware that, okay, me and my partner want to live together, I would advise parties to that relationship to do the following. So the first would be enter into what is known as a cohabitation agreement or a domestic partnership agreement. Have something in writing that sets out what I am bringing in, what are you bringing in? What am I paying for? What are you paying for? What would happen if we broke up, if we split up? What would happen on your death? I would then encourage those parties to have a will drawn up. And in that will, nominate each other as beneficiaries and specify the relationship. It doesn't help to put me in your will and just state my name. Who am I to you? The other thing I would do is consult with an attorney. Oftentimes, attorneys get a bad rap. We are the grudge purchase, understandably. But consult with an attorney, even if it's a brief consultation, to understand the risks that your arrangement presents to you. Because should your partner die or should you break up, you then need to prove this relationship in court. And the court will look at various factors. The court will look at the duration of the relationship. They will look at whether or not you lived together, how long you lived together. They will look at how you presented as a couple. So when you attend events for work or social events, how do you introduce your partner? Is this my partner? Is this my boyfriend? Is this my friend? How do you represent each other on social media, for example? In policy documents, what have you classified your partner as in your pension fund nomination forms? They will look at that. They will also look at if there's a shared intention to be in this life partnership. They will look at what you've pooled together as a couple. So your financial investments made and emotional support. Did you create a life together? Were there children there? What were your contributions? So those factors are not exhaustive, but those are some of the things that parties to this arrangement or this relationship need to keep in mind. Mm. And I think, Maya, this is why I say to women specifically, and I know it's gendered and I acknowledge that, but the reality is in our country, women are the vulnerable group. It's okay to date and be in a committed relationship for love. However, it is also okay to want protection in that relationship, to want financial protection, to want legal protection, and to have those conversations with your partner. Because the reality is, it will leave you exposed if you don't have those conversations when things are still good.
And I think, Maya, exactly to Lerato's point, have the conversations when things are still easy, when we are still looking at each other as this is the love of my life. Mm. And have the conversation and say, let's protect one another. And I think if you approach it that way, then it takes away the weight of it, of saying, oh, goodness, you want to sign stuff now. Yes, let's protect one another. Show me that you love me by protecting me, and I'm going to sign stuff, and I'm going to show you that I love you.
And I think if you're unable to have those conversations, it can be a red flag.
Yes.
So actually sometimes yes. It starts. And I just also want to end off, Mapalo, with saying, you know, you spoke about go see an attorney. Go see an attorney when you're getting married as well with the contracts. Really?
Absolutely.
I mean, it's really worth the investment. How much do we spend on weddings?
And oh, man.
And the shoes?
People are spending upward north of like close to millions. And yet the very thing that's supposed to protect you and it's going to cost you a couple of thousand of rands, we don't do it. Mm. We don't have enough time for it. For me, that is the most important piece of paper.
Mm,
and every time before anyone gets married, even with the mentees, I always say, I am holding you to account. There's one getting married in November. She says, you know what? I'm just saving for my to see the lawyer, the notary. Mm. I said, by the end of August, I am giving you a call to find out if you've gone.
Well, that's excellent. And thank you so much. That was so valuable. I have been listening to every word that's come out your mouth. I'm thinking, gosh, this is such valuable content. And thank you so much for sharing that with our listeners. I really appreciate it. And to you, our listeners and viewers, I hope you enjoyed that. And you can always drop us some questions if you need to know more. And then remember to tune in for our next episode where we're going to be looking at investing and growing wealth, and what is compound and what is real returns versus nominal returns, and how do you know how much you need at retirement, and all those good things. Mapalo, we're going to be dealing with
that. Oh my goodness, I'm so excited for that episode. Everyone knows that we love talking about investments, and we will see you then.